animation, like any other art form, is not a marathon, it's a relay. And each generation takes the baton, remakes it to their own taste, and then passes it on to the next.
Welcome to Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts. I'm your host, S.W. Konser, and today I'm joined by an animation historian who's written for the New York Times, Variety, and National Public Radio. His 22 books include The Disney That Never Was, Enchanted Drawings, The History of Animation, and Animation for the People, an illustrated history of the National Film Board of Canada. Charles Solomon, welcome to Words and Pictures.
Thank you. Very nice to meet you.
So, Charles, we mentioned that you've written a number of books about animation, art, and history. Something that I noticed right away when I open up one of your books is the quality of the art, the color reproductions, the line work. This isn't the case with every art book I see.
Well, I don't think there's much point in doing an art book if the reproductions aren't good. This has been a problem for years. If you look at some, for example, some of the older books on Japanese prints, which I've gotten increasingly interested in over the last couple decades, studying their influence on anime, they would get very green in the reproductions. And what's the point in that if you're trying to discuss with your audience, okay, what is it that makes this significant? What sets it apart? What distinguishes it? If they can't see it, how can you expect them to understand it? For the last several years, I've been working with a couple of really good editors at Abrams, and not only are they very conscientious about that, the quality of printing and presses has just improved so much with the digital revolution that you can bring the image to the people as pristine and crisp as possible, and they can appreciate the quality of it. When you look at the drawings of some of these artists from the NFB, from Disney, from Pixar, these are some of the great draftsmen working today. You know, Glenn Keane can stand up against, Takiko Inoue, against anyone, any easel artist drawing today. Whereas, you know, many painters who are in galleries, if you drop them in a life class, wouldn't know what to do. But these people have studied anatomy and the human figure and just the very basics of drawing and are so good, you want to bring that work and share it because the quality of the drawings is what's exciting.
It's really been only in recent years, recent decades, that you've seen animation art, comic art in museums. And I'm assuming that you've developed your eye working with folks at museums. You've been involved with exhibitions. You've written essays for museum catalogs.
Well, I actually started out with 2 degrees in cultural history. I was cutting my intellectual teeth looking at great painters and printmakers and sculptors. And there is a continuity. The artists at Disney who really developed the art of animation were graduates from top art schools. They had some of the best art instructors in the country, people like Don Graham, Enrico Lebrun, and Palmer Schoppe, all teaching there and learning what goes into drawing the human figure accurately. How do you capture movement in a way that is believable? You have to make it clear that the figure is moving against gravity. And your audience may not know, oh, they got the rhythm of that walk wrong, but they'll know something doesn't look right if you don't have that basis. And then artists and other places, whether the Warner Brothers and MGM cartoonists or more individual artists like the Hubleys and many of the National Film Board artists, go on to take that knowledge and stylize it and push it in new directions and do things with it for comic or dramatic effect. But they still have that underlying knowledge that's the basis of drawing and just putting a line on paper in a way that will communicate.
Yeah, you bring a lot of that cultural history and that technical know-how to this big book that you're famous for. It's called Enchanted Drawings, The History of Animation. It's about as exhaustive as it comes in going from the silent era to modern day.
Well, I was born at a convenient time so that when I began writing, I was in grad school, many of the old artists were still alive and could be interviewed. And in those days, newspapers were big. The Friday art section of the LA Times might be 24, 28, 36 pages. So there was space they needed to fill. And I could go to the editors I worked with and say, hey, they're re-releasing this Disney feature. I could interview Mark Davis about the villainesses and how he created Cruella de Vil or Maleficent in this film. Or, there are these interesting new artists, Glenn Keane, Matt Groening, Hayao Miyazaki. They're really doing some interesting new stuff. Let's do something about them. Or for a book I'm working on right now, when I first saw The Family Dog and said, there's a director named Brad Bird. You got to let me write a piece about him. This is something new and really good. So that all came together, and I was able to meet some of the artists who had worked in the silent days. My friend John Kanemaker, another eminent historian of animation, took me to Fort Lee, New Jersey once to meet Otto Messmer, who was in his late 80s then and getting a bit frail, but this is the creator of Felix the Cat. This is as close to the source as you could get in those days, Winsor McCay having, died before. So that kind of all came together, and the art history training that I'd gotten from my profs at UCLA came in very handy. That was also true on the book on the film board that, okay, you can look at something and say, yeah, this is around the time that Frank Stella is also experimenting with this kind of geometric form. And, this artist is doing this with this kind of imagery because animation doesn't exist in a vacuum. The people who make it are generally very knowledgeable artists, people like Milt Kahl, who had been married to a woman who ran a gallery for a while and became infatuated with Picasso. Mark Davis studied animal anatomy and the art of Papua New Guinea. So they brought all this to their work, and by sort of helping to explain this to your audience, I think you give them more respect for the filmmakers and a greater understanding of what they're looking at.
Well, before we talk about your book, Animation for the People, let's give a little background about the National Film Board of Canada. Before the NFB, there was an agency with the lilting name of the Canadian Government Motion Picture Bureau, and this started back in the silent era at the end of World War I.
Yeah, it just kind of sings, doesn't it? They had, I mean, aside from them, there was virtually no filmmaking in Canada then. There weren't studios. American companies sometimes, came up to shoot things on location. And that government agency was getting very ossified and very stale. They were still making silent films in 1934. It's a little behind the times, maybe. So people of in power in Canada realized we need to kind of upgrade and update. And they found John Grierson, a Scot who was a great scholar of film. He only made one film, but he understood it and analyzed it and wrote about it and coined the term documentary. And he basically came up with the idea of the National Film Board. It got written into a bill and was passed by Parliament, approved, got the royal approval, and came into existence in 1939. And there were some clashes between it and the older organization. But Grierson was one of those inspiring leaders. He's one of those people I really regret I didn't get to meet, like John Hubley or Walt Disney. The timing was wrong. But he was someone you would follow. He was intense. He was a heavy drinker. He had a temper, but he believed in film. And although he had conceived of the board as a peacetime entity, by the time it was created, Canada was at war as part of the, British Commonwealth. And so you had a huge country, I think it's close to 10 million square kilometers, but it only had about 11 million people scattered amid this continent-sized expanse of land, who were divided in many ways, linguistically and geographically and culturally. And Grierson's mission was to bring the people of Canada together, saying, we've got to make them realize they are a great people. And you don't do that by forcing them, you persuade them. And so he saw the board as a way of uniting the country and uniting them behind the war effort. And not only were many of the films dealing with wartime themes and newsreels, he saw to it that even the people in the remote little villages scattered across the prairies and into the far north got to see the films because they equipped, there were men who had very, very sturdy projectors, generators, and reels of film, and they went out by car and boat and dog sled to these little villages and showed the films in grange halls and barns and community buildings and schools. And he did what he set out to do, but he was apparently a fascinating man and one that, as busy as his schedule was, if someone brought up an idea about a film that he liked, he would just stop and sit down and talk about it with them. He also did not only the board, but the world of animation and the art of animation a favor by hiring another Scotsman, Norman Maclaren, to set up the animation division of the board. Maclaren wasn't exactly ecstatic about that. He wanted to make films, and people who knew him said, well, you could only talk so much to Norman because his mind was on what he was filming and what technique he was inventing. Genius is a horribly overused word in our culture. I think animation has probably produced four. Winsor McCay, who creates the art form out of nothing. Walt Disney, who completely transforms the art of animation to something no one, even the animators, had thought it could become. Hayao Miyazaki, who in some ways is doing the same thing in our time. And then McLaren, who invented techniques and ways of creating imagery and analyzing movement and animation to a degree that no one had really done before, and no one else has done with the same kind of insight and creativity. There were people who had tried putting images directly on film, but they didn't work the way his did. Or lots of people had created artificial sound going back to the 20s in Hungary, but no one used it as effectively as he did in a film like Neighbors. Sometimes when you put something in a solution, everything will crystallize around it. And he was that kind of force in that world of animation, that his work was inspiring and exciting. He encouraged young artists, and his films were the greatest recruitment tool you could find. Robert Verrill told me he'd been an art student. He saw McLaren's C'est l'Aveyron. I said, I didn't know we did anything like this in Canada. I didn't know we did animation at all. I was astounded, and I was more astounded 2 weeks later when I got a letter inviting me to come to the board and work with them. And that was the case of many of the young artists.
Like you tell it in the book, John Grierson and Norman Maclaren were both very charismatic, very visionary people, both Scotsmen, but radically different in their personalities. I mean, John Grierson was gruff. He had been studying mass media and propaganda in the United States, which
Right.
helped a great deal when World War II broke out. Norman Maclaren, he had seen the brutality of the Spanish Civil War. He doesn't want to do pro-war propaganda. So it's a little bit awkward. Here he is, tapped to head up the new animation studio at the National Film Board in the 1940s. So most of the work that he does himself has to do with promoting solidarity at home, buying war bonds, things like that.
Well, it's what we would call PSAs, public service ads today, or spots. And yeah, it's mail early, put your money in bonds. It's Christmas, so get your packages in the mail, those kinds of things. But he's also working on the chant populaire, the popular song films, which were another kind of cultural bonding experience. The idea that you take these old folk songs that everybody knows and you get people in theaters singing along with them. The Fleischers had experimented with something similar in the 20s with the song Cartoons, where we get the phrase follow the bouncing ball. And these were, again, chances to do something that weren't standard Hollywood style cartoons at all. C'est l'aviron, it's the paddle, is this kind of fantasy journey down a Canadian river. And he did little partial landscapes in gouache, mostly white and gray on black backgrounds. And it's one long series of dissolves that are overlapping. So you fade from one image into the other so slowly you don't realize it's happening. But you feel like you're just gliding down this fantasy Canadian river. Nobody had ever done anything like that before. Le Merle, he uses simple cutouts. And when I went to the board looking at illustrations and doing research, they still have them. And I got to very reverently look at and touch, the cutouts that he and Evelyn Lombard had manipulated to create the motion in that film. So the work was exciting, and the other artists learned from him, were inspired by him. I mean, they would have their own approaches. Evelyn Lombard goes on to do her own films, and very interesting ones. The other young artists, some of them stayed at the board, like Robert Verrill did. Others, like George Dunning and Jerry Potterton, went on and started studios of their own. So even in those early days, it was a center of creativity, very different from the Hollywood studios, who were doing most of the animation at that point. There was, some work being done in Japan and some in Europe, but the United States was really the focus then because of the dominance of Disney, and then the other studios that sort of followed in his wake. And here was something completely different, closer in some ways to some of the experiments of people in Europe, like Oskar Fischinger and Viking Ägling and that whole Northeastern European group of experimental artists.
Yeah, McLaren really had a passion for experimentation, and that became infectious at the National Film Board. He tried out different techniques himself, paint on film, pixelation, and other artists were playing around with paint on glass, with this technology called pin screen animation. So there was, at least early on, this real culture of if it doesn't work out, try something new.
Well, and if it doesn't work, you wouldn't be fired. Not every experiment succeeds. McLaren, of course, he joked about being a mingy Scotsman, and he saved, all his outtakes and all his notes and so forth, and they've been cataloged at the board, fortunately. So they're there. Not everyone was that thorough, but there was the sense that, okay, this is the technique I'm going to try. It's gotten approved, but it isn't necessarily working out. A couple of the artists I interviewed said, yeah, I was supposed to be writing a film about this, but it wasn't working. And then my son was born, and I realized how strange it was to have this being in my house. So I made a completely different film. And you were allowed to put a personal spin. You mentioned paint on glass. You have three really interesting women artists, Carolyn Leaf, Martine Chartrand, and Wendy Tilby, all of whom use paint on glass completely differently. Their styles, the content of their films are so different. And that was fine, just because Carolyn had pretty much pioneered it with one look and one kind of motion, didn't mean that anyone expected Wendy to work the same way or to produce the same kind of film, or yet again, Martine, who's doing something completely different that's closer to the work of the Russian artist Alexander Petrov. But they're still all working at the board. They're still all producing paint on glass films that are highly personal and very much in the tradition that McLaren envisioned of the individual artist probably working under the camera alone. Again, Robert Verrill, who I was very lucky to find that he had come to the board in 1947 when he was 17. He had an amazing memory. He was still just so sharp, you would get tired. So we did like little half-hour interviews. But he remembered when McLaren saw Carolyn Leaves the Street, he wept at the end because he was so moved by its beauty and that someone had followed his vision and was the individual artist creating this amazing film directly under the camera. So there was nothing left at the end but the final image.
You mentioned a number of women animators, like Evelyn Lambert. Early on, she was there. Later on, there was Caroline Leaf, Janet Perelman, Martine Chartrand, Wendy Tilby, and Amanda Forbes. Lottie Reininger came over in the 1960s. She had directed the first animated feature, The Adventures of Prince Ahmed, in 1926. So while at American studios like Disney's, women had been restricted to support roles, mostly in the ink and paint department, at the National Film Board, women directors seem to have more autonomy.
And that comes from Grierson, who hired women and gave them, positions of responsibility. The entire negative cutting department, not something people have to do anymore, but a microscopically delicate task, was entirely staffed by women. And McLaren and Evelyn Lombard worked very, very closely together until he really got interested in the dance films, which didn't interest her, and she went on to do her own films using cutouts. But that was very much a partnership. And in recent years, I'm really glad that she started to get the credit that she deserved. And Grierson, again, set that policy that women could do what they wanted to in that studio. If they could prove that they were directors, they were directing. Toril Kova won the Oscar for The Danish Poet, which cracks me up every time I watch it. I was in Vancouver recently giving a talk and got to see Alison Snowden and David Fine, a husband and wife team who did Bob's Birthday, another film that I'd still giggle over every time I see it. As you mentioned, Janet Perelman, Wendy Tilby, and Amanda Forbes, who have four Oscar nominations. And Perelman's work ranges from some things that are rather serious, like Bully Dance. It's not a dour, but is dealing with a serious subject of bullying, to the absurdity of Why Me and the Little Man Who Has 5 Minutes to Live, and of course the touching tale of Cinderella Penguin, which she fills with such lovely details as a webbed glass slipper and a leghorn tapestry with a penguin in the middle of it. So they're giving us visions, or Carolyn Leaf, who finally retired from the board and is now painting. Kind of a reverse. You also have Michel Lemieux, who's taken over the pin screen, which you mentioned, from Jacques Drouin, who we recently lost. But what's interesting is she's made it completely her own. Her films look nothing like Drouin's or Alexei Evan Parker, who created it. Even just the individual lines have a signature quality to them. And so here's an artist who's very clearly expressing her vision on this incredibly difficult technique. It's one of those things I've said that for some of these techniques at the board, it's like a bare foot connected to a hand, and the hand scatters tacks for the foot to walk on. The pin screen, many of your listeners probably haven't seen one, is a couple of 100,000 steel pins mounted in a vertical matrix. And how far in you push each pin determines how long a shadow it casts. So if the pin is pushed way in and it's just got a small shadow, it reads as a light gray. If it's further out, it's a longer shadow, it seems darker. And the images are built up almost like a Seurat or some other pointillist canvas out of little individual touches or spots of black and white. And I understand that intellectually. I cannot imagine trying to create one of those images, let alone make it move from one place to the other. No, there's some gland maybe that people like Jacques Drouin and Michel have, who have always, are very nice, have always, extremely nice people, but I don't have, or how does Carolyn Leaf, move the figures around in the street? particularly towards the end where you're moving in three dimensions and the laundry is blowing overhead and the little boy is leapfrogging over a fire hydrant.
This is the adaptation of the Mordecai Richler story, The Street.
Yes. You know, how do you think that way? I don't know, but there's would be no way to do something like that in a conventional commercial studio. So this goes back to something I've talked about in many books is from the inception of animation on film, there's always been a dichotomy between studio cartoons, which are like operas. It requires a huge crew all working together, and if they're working together properly, the results are staggering, versus it as a real extension of the traditional graphic and visual arts, where it may be one or two people working alone, pursuing some individual vision that is as personal as any canvas or etching or engraving or sculpture. So this is very much that second tradition of animation, the individual art form that one artist can express him or herself in ways that no one else probably can do. You know, they've tried to copy pin screen animation and CG, and it doesn't work.
Speaking of autonomy and individual expression, you know, the animated shorts commissioned by the National Film Board, I mean, they'd be entertaining, but they would often still be public service films. The government might say, make a film about fire safety or job resources, but then beyond that, the filmmaker would have a pretty free hand with the content.
Yeah, well, a good example, two examples of that that come to mind. One are Pig Bird, that was one of Richard Condy's first films, where someone smuggles in this weird-looking creature, brings it home, starts to pet it, and all these bugs start pouring off it. And they attack not only the idiot who violated the customs laws, but his yard, and then as the camera pulls back, his town, the whole province, and the entire globe. And it's absurd and it's hilarious. But it makes its point. And of course, the fire safety film you mentioned is Hot Stuff by Zlatko Grijik, the Yugoslavian animator from Zagreb, who came there and did this, which is supposed to be a fire safety film, but deals, or actually an electricity safety film. But it is so absurd and so hilarious with the wonderful cat at the end talking about cream. Cats need their cream. Did you get the cream? But it makes its point, and it makes it more effectively than just some grim, dull, didactic thing would. It's, you know, in some ways in the tradition of films like the tax films that Disney did for the government during World War II, or that the private snafus that Warner Brothers and MGM did to help train the GIs, that they realized that humor was a way to make these points, and it would stick in people's memories in a way that a don't do this lecture wouldn't.
Well, you're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Konser. And today we're talking with animation historian Charles Solomon, author of the books Enchanted Drawings, The History of Animation, The Man Who Leapt Through Film, The Art of Mamoru Hosoda, and Animation for the People, An Illustrated History of the National Film Board of Canada. When I was living in Toronto, I noticed that short films would play regularly on the TV stations, and this is also common in England. It's really not a thing in the US.
No, I mean, for a little while, we had a few shows like The Curiosity Shop and The Great American Dream Machine that showed offbeat experimental animation. That was where I first saw some of the Hubley films. And maybe so, there was also the International Animation Showcase, I think it was, with Jean Marsh.
Interestingly, though, one of the American shows that a lot of animators got work on was Sesame Street.
Yes. And later on, Pee-wee's Playhouse. They were allowed to do a lot of very strange things there, including the artist who invented what I'm forgetting his name, and I know him.
David Daniels.
Yeah, really nice guy. But that was a very film boardy kind of technique where he would make a long loaf of clay, and as he sliced it and photographed it, the things inside would animate. And so he was thinking of the third dimension as time. Once again, I don't know how you do it, but he sure did. And that again shows the influence of the board on these unusual techniques. Stephen Johnson was in charge of a lot of that, overseeing it. And he also did a film that illustrated the Declaration of Human Rights that the UN had issued, that was done with a big Amnesty International tour years ago. And I remember interviewing him, and once again, the film board influence can be seen on that kind of free work because every right was illustrated by a different artist.
Now, one story that you tell in the book that's really indicative of the reach of the National Film Board. In the 1970s, there was a separatist movement in French-speaking Quebec, and the Canadian broadcasting system was eager to try and mend the breach. And so a short story by Roche Carrier was adapted to film by animator Sheldon Cohen.
Yes, that's The Sweater, which is one of the most viewed films in the history of the board. And Carrier was a rising literary star in Quebec at the time. And they gave him the question, what do the Quebecois want? And instead of trying to write some political tract, he did this memoir of being a little boy in a tiny rural village in Quebec and the trauma he had had when his mother bought him a Toronto Maple Leafs sweater rather than a Montreal Canadiens sweater, which was led by Maurice Rocket Richard. And this was, the end of the world for an adolescent boy at that time. And Sheldon said that he was initially a little reluctant because he came from an urban Jewish English-speaking milieu. He didn't play hockey, but the story was so good, who could resist it? And Carrier narrates it with a very, distinctive voice and a very much Quebecois accent. The only change he made in that was he said when he showed it, Norman McLaren came and liked it, but he said, goes a little flat at the ending. You should probably just fill up the screen with more moths. And so Sheldon said, with great trepidation, I went to this noted artist and said, would you mind changing the last line of your story to something like 10 million moths to come and eat the sweater? And he said, no problem, and re-recorded the line. And now the film ends on that note. The other film that is usually grouped with that is The Log Driver's Waltz, which is apparently the most viewed film from the numbers they gave me. And that started when John Weldon, who had won the Oscar with Eunice Macaulay for Special Delivery, heard the McGarrigle sisters sing this song and thought it was fun. And then they discovered it had actually been written for an NFB documentary back in the 50s. But the documentarians didn't like it. They were making a serious film about loggers. And they weren't this stupid thing waltzing over the logs. No, that's not serious enough for a documentary. And so they went to the composer, Hemsworth, I believe, and said, can we do an animated film? And he said, yes. And the result is, of course, hilarious, with the idea that once you've danced with a man who goes running over the spinning logs in the river all day, anyone else is flat-footed and dull. So it's very silly, very animated, and the sort of humor you can only do in animation. Obviously, you couldn't make it work in live action.
Well, on the other side of the country, some of the most memorable animated shorts came from the prairie provinces. The animators out west had a gift for comedy, and that became known as the Winnipeg style. The most
Right.
popular examples are probably Richard Condie's The Big Snit and Cordell Barker's The Cat Came Back.
Yes, I mean, both hilarious films, both that still bring down the house wherever you show them. If you go to any sort of revival, or when I was teaching at UCLA, I would show that, and the whole class would just be on the floor laughing at those two films. It's there's a just a take no prisoners absurdity to it. They aren't necessarily the most exquisitely drawn films the board ever released, but they don't need to be. And while there's some influence of the Warner Brothers MGM, slapstick humor of the classic cartoons, they give it their own Canadian spin and an absurdity to it. When you look at The Big Snit, even the backgrounds are funny. If you not only are the in one place, there's a picture hanging with its face to the wall. There are, of course, saw marks in the walls and in the furniture. There's a bugle hanging over the bed, and there's a DC-10 tire in the dining room. And that's the way these people live, thank you very much. And they're comfortable that way. But beneath the absurdity of that film, you still realize that these people love each other. Their life, it reminds me of some of the Far Side cartoons. It's strange to us, but this is the way we live, thank you very much, and we're content this way. And I remember at Annecy, I was hanging out with Richard and Ishu Patel one year, the year that he had done The Big Snit. And at the press conference, someone asked him if he saw the furniture in his house. And he got annoyed and said, yes. And they believed him. And then he got really annoyed because, yeah, of course, I sit around and saw the furniture while I watch Sawing for Teens. He also later discovered that there was a pub in London that called itself The Big Snit, and they served little saws in the drinks instead of parasols. And he said, it would have been fun to sneak in there, but I didn't have the time. We were talking before that you said you've had David Silverman as a guest on the show. I met David his first day at UCLA Film School. Dan McLaughlin introduced us, and we spent the next 3 or 4 years at adjoining animation desks making our films and talking, and we've never stopped. And he said when he and Wes Archer were doing the first animation of the Simpsons characters, those films were an inspiration to them. They were their own drawings that were coming onto the screen, and they wanted that same absurdity and to get that kind of laugh through the drawings.
This was when The Simpsons were on the Tracey Ullman show. They were the little short vignettes before it
Yes.
became a regular show. And
Yeah, it was
so
like
they were,
90 seconds a week, I think.
so the animators were watching. The cat came back and taking notes.
Yeah, and learning from it, which is how any art form works. I remember one interview I did with Miyazaki. He said that animation, like any other art form, is not a marathon, it's a relay. And each generation takes the baton, remakes it to their own taste, and then passes it on to the next. And he said, one day, I'll be ready to pass it on if someone's there and wants to receive it. And that's very much what you get with some of the work of any great studio, whether it's Disney or the National Film Board or Aardman, that they're all, oh yeah, I was influenced by this, I watched this and learned from that. I remember Nick Park saying that some of Co Hodeman's stop motion at the NFB was an influence when he was a student and a kid, that he would try moving things like after watching Choo Choo, his animated block film. Nick started experimenting with like things that he found in his mother's sewing kit or other everyday objects and just seeing what could you do with that movement? Could you create a sense of a personality or of a character, or just how did the movement work? So that baton keeps getting passed on. And there are other stop motion artists now who are influenced, by Nick and his work. And that baton keeps getting passed. And it's just that the people of Canada have been extraordinarily generous in giving us this place where artists can experiment and develop and grow and try and bring us things that we otherwise wouldn't be able to see. During the 60s and 70s, when most of the big Hollywood studios had closed, Disney was just doing an occasional feature after Walt's death and was kind of sleepwalking at that point. The new team hadn't come in yet. And there was that, and there was Saturday morning. So the creative artists were looking for other outlets and other sources of inspiration. And the film board really was the center of creativity and experimentation in animation then, that You could make three Oscars in a row with Sandcastle. I mean, animating sand, what a nightmare. Because if it shifts the tiniest bit between frames, it will shimmer and boil on the screen. And Kahoteman told me that he had used glycerin on it to keep it moist and in place and movable, and it was good for his skin too. Although one problem he hadn't anticipated was a stray cat got in one night and used part of the set as a litter box. But that was followed by special delivery, which was hand-drawn on paper in colored pencil, an absurd tale about a man who doesn't shovel off his walk and the postman slips and breaks his neck and they've just got to try and hide the body. And then that was followed by Every Child, which was cell animation,
Derek Lamb.
Darryl Lamb. And that was for the UNICEF's Year of the Child, illustrating the beliefs that every child had a right to a home, a nationality, to care, because you've got this baby that people keep just passing on because they don't want to be bothered with it. And it's full of pseudo dialogue done by, I think it was Les Mimes Electroniques, a sort of comedy group in Montreal at the time. There's one sequence that's a fake opera. There's a hilarious section where an old couple takes in the baby and their dog feels neglected and starts doing all the housework and weeping because it's not the center of attention anymore. And again, it's a very serious subject. And the board would go back to some of the rights of the child issues in their films. But, that was three Oscars in a row.
And in 1952, when Malcolm McLaren won his Oscar for Neighbors, his very powerful anti-war short film, that was considered best documentary short. The Oscar committee did not consider his pixelation to be animation.
Well, I assume that was because it was so different. All they would have probably had seen was cell animation at that point. That's really all there was in the mainstream. So where do you put this? And it's a technique that had been around for decades, but no one had ever found a way to use it before with such effectiveness and such power. And Grant Munro, who's one of the figures in it, and who was another one of McLaren's assistants, co-filmmakers, said that they were shooting that on this huge lawn by someone's estate, but it was on a tour bus route. And so he said, I would be throttling the other artist, and the tour bus would come by and say, "Now on your left, the historic village of." He said, "I wonder what those people said when they got home to Peoria."
And unfortunately, as you say in the book, the National Film Board has been constantly battling against funding cuts for, decades.
Well, that's the problem with any government cultural agency is there are people in some areas of politics who don't think we should spend money on culture. In the United States, we don't have a minister of culture as most industrialized countries do. It might be a mixed blessing at this time, but again, it's not an enormous amount of money they're spending. It comes out to a couple of dollars a year per person. And they've also worked to make the films more available, I think, to help people realize just what a treasure they have. There's the NFB app, which if your listeners don't have, you can get for free, for your phone or tablet. And most of the animation and a lot of the documentaries are available for your personal viewing. And one of the reasons I wanted to write the book was just as a thank you for this incredible generosity and what they've given us that I, for one, am very, very grateful for.
So, Charles, we mentioned that you're a prolific writer. You received the LA Press Club Award for Radio Feature Reporting and Asifa Hollywood's June Foray Award for Service to the Art of Animation in 2015. I think what people might find surprising about your books is how much background material is in some of them. Like, for example, people who enjoy the Pixar movies, the Disney movies, you've got The Art of Frozen, and very little of the art in that is computer generated. You've got sketches that are done on paper. You've got watercolor. You've got sculpted miniatures.
Well, I think that's partially what interests me, that even for the older films, I think animators' drawings are more interesting than cells. No offense, as you were an Incan painter. But in the drawings, you see the mind of the artist at work. And I remember it was Ken Anderson, one of the great Disney artists, who said, if you do a drawing, any tracing of it will not have the same life, even if you trace it yourself. And I think that's very true in animation. You look at the rough drawings of someone like Glenn Keane, and yeah, it looks like he's drawn with a pencil in his fist, but you see those move, and they're so powerful. And I remember some of the old artists telling me that the pencil test for Night on Bald Mountain in Fantasia looked like a Michelangelo in motion. And some of that very often gets lost in the film, that roughness, that spontaneity. And the people who would look at a book like the one on Frozen or the one I did on Toy Story 3 will have seen those images. They know those, but they don't know how those images came to be. And how did the artist develop that character? Where did it come from? What did they do when they were experimenting with color? When you look at Daisuke Tsuzumi's gorgeous color script for that film, or the little draws, the storyboard drawings. I remember on the Toy Story 3 book, seeing the storyboards of the sequence where you think the toys are going to go into the incinerator. And the moment when the characters take each other's hands, boy, I was misting up. And I'm a crabby old critic. And that was just as powerful in the finished film. But I think by showing people where the art comes from, what happens in the exploration phase and the development phase, you help them to understand the finished film and give them a respect for the artists who make it and how hard they work and just how wonderful some of the creations are. And sometimes something doesn't make it to one film, but will come back later. The Pixar artist created Lotso, the villainous pink teddy bear from Toy Story 3, was originally going to be in Toy Story 1. He didn't fit in the story. And when they finally got around to that, they realized, hey, he would work here. And Danny Arriaga polished the designs. And they talked to a toy maker because they said, this is supposed to be a cheap bear. He's mass produced. So they had, again, a real toy maker come in and explain, okay, the seams would go here because that would be less expensive than if you made the model this way. And they also said that they were going to build a bear and getting funny looks because they were doing all these weird-looking bears with no fur. And the people at the store were, getting them, what's with you? Oh. But as a result, you can create a believable character who looks like what he's supposed to be, that is, a cheap industrial product. Whereas some of the other toys, like Buzz Lightyear, are supposed to be higher end. And there are different details in him, and the way the screws that hold the plastic parts together are fit and designed. Walt Disney always believed in that kind of research. That's why he built the educational program that transformed animation at his studio. And it goes back to what we were talking about earlier about understanding anatomy and how the artists on Bambi studied real animals. And Rico Lebrun, I think it was dissecting a roadkill deer for them that was getting riper and riper. And they were sort of drawing with their sketch pads at arm's length. But by understanding the musculature and the joints, they could make Bambi move like a believable deer. And that process goes on today. When I was a kid, I wanted to be a vertebrate paleontologist. So I grew up drawing bones and dissecting lizards and so forth, trying to understand how a dinosaur would work. And when I was in grad school in film, I met Stuart Sumita, who was in grad school in comparative anatomy. And we gave a sort of mini class because I was surprised that some of the other animation students didn't know how an elbow worked. So we did sort of a basic anatomy. And then when Disney was making Beauty and the Beast, they were having some trouble with the horses and the wolves. And I said, you should talk to this guy. And since then, he has a second career. He's a professor of comparative anatomy at Cal State San Bernardino. But he also lectures to the studios explaining, okay, this is how this joint works. And if this animal has this kind of joint, it's going to have to move this way. And if you're imagining an animal, you have to be thinking in those terms. You know, how is it built? What's its step cycle? What kind of hip does it have? What kind of knee? And again, that's part of that same knowledge that you need because you have to understand reality before you can caricature it.
There's storm clouds on the horizon. I want to get your opinion on this. When I talk to art instructors and they show their students concept art, like the kind in your books, a lot of the young people will say, oh, that's generative AI, artificial intelligence. It's like everybody is suspicious that any art that has a high level of mastery must be generative AI.
Well, that's depressing. And that's, you know, clearly one of the big questions facing all the arts at this point is where will this go? How will it be used? How will it be misused? In this country, art schools don't teach drawing anymore, which is, I think, a grave mistake. And when you talk to artists in Europe or in Asia and see their work, you see the difference. When I went to the University at Salamanca a couple of years ago, they have a library of bones. If you're drawing something and really want to study a femur, you can go and check one out and take it to your house and sketch it and study it and measure it and understand its forms and its complexities so that when you go to draw it in something finished, you'll know how to do it. There's no substitute for that. And you know, there have been some weird AI things. There was that fake Ghibli program that was trying to turn everything into a pseudo Miyazaki. I'm not interested in that. I think there are probably unscrupulous producers and money men who will want to use this to try and crank stuff out cheaply. But I can't imagine any real animator or any real artist wanting to use that or do that. It's in that struggle to get the image in your mind onto the page, the words you want onto the page. That's what makes us who we are. You know, I remember once at lunch with Glenn Keane saying, if you were a bat stranded on a desert island like Robinson Crusoe, you'd find a way to draw, you know, whether it's charcoal on palm leaves or a stick in the wet sand or something on rocks. And he sort of nodded, and then he turned to me and said, and you'd keep a journal. And okay, busted. you know, that's what makes an artist, that struggle, that creation. And in some ways, it's easier to do now than it's done in the past. You know, there are enormous numbers of short films being produced because you can do it much more cheaply now with a home computer system and some extras. You can make a film, which you couldn't do 10, 20, 30 years ago. That doesn't mean it's going to be a good film. It doesn't mean that everyone who has that equipment has a good idea. And sitting through some of the qualifying films, I can assure you they didn't. But there's an authenticity to what you create that I haven't seen in anything from AI, but it's something that is very worrisome. In some ways, it has enormous potential. But it's potential like nuclear power that can be used for good or for evil. So the question is, how will we take this? How will we use it? And can we use it in ways that will enhance creativity, as computer graphics did in some ways, that suddenly you could have the tracking shot in Beauty and the Beast, that going down from the chandelier and waltzing with Belle and Beast around the ballroom, that you couldn't do in conventional 2D, or the wildebeest stampede in Lion King, or the contrast between the CG and drawn realms in The Iron Giant. None of those would have really been possible before. On the other hand, it shouldn't replace drawn animation, which has other strengths. Stop motion has other strengths. And I think one reason we've seen this unprecedented flowering of stop motion from the Aardmans and Leica and Tim Burton and Guillermo del Toro is that people don't like the perfection of CG, the spotless, geometrized, flawless world. And there's a handmadeness to stop motion that gives it a warmth and a different kind of vitality. I remember once I was out with Nick Park, I was probably doing a Q&A with him, and he looked at one of the photos outside the theater and said, "Oh, that's my scene, that's my thumbprint in Wallace's neck." And again, that gives the work a humanity and a warmth that CG may not have or that drawings may not suggest. So the question becomes always, what medium, what kind of animation is the best way to tell the story you're trying to tell? And then use it to the best of your ability to present that idea as effectively as you can.
You've written about UPA, United Productions of America. They've sort of gotten a new cachet in the 21st century for their mid-century modern stylings. They were ahead of their time back in the 40s and 50s. And when the whole era of flash animation and simplified figures came around, they were much studied.
Oh, yeah. For example, if you talk to Genndy Tartakovsky, his hero is Bob Cannon. And when you look at Genndy's animation in something like Samurai Jack or Primal, you can see his understanding of poses and how to move from one to the other to telegraph a mood or a movement to the audience that he's learned from them. Yes, he's given it his own spin. Even in the Hotel Transylvania movies, look at the way he moves Dracula from one pose to the other. It's very staccato, as opposed to his slacker son-in-law, who they give these outrageously ridiculous walks and expressions and shoulder slumps. But there's still that underlying knowledge and learning from the UPA artists about what a pose can do, how to make it read, and then how to go to the next one in a way that's effective and in keeping with the style that you're creating. The key artists at UPA, people like John Hubley, Steve Basesto, Bob Cannon, Dave Hilberman, were all trained at Disney and in the classic fine arts. But they were more excited by Picasso and Matisse and Saul Steinberg and the New Yorker cartoonists and Miró and Klee and Kandinsky. And so they could take this knowledge and once again stylize it. You look, for example, at Rudy Toot Toot, my favorite of all the UPA films, very balletic. Hubley had hired a local choreographer to do poses for the characters, particularly Frankie. But there's still that underlying sense of anatomy and design and color and texture and pattern that all goes into making those images. As they're moving, really register with your eye. It makes you understand the story. It entertains you. And there's a difference between drawing a simple figure when you have that kind of background and someone who doesn't, who just draws a funny little shape because it's all he can draw.
So you've written extensively about Japanese animation. There is a big book that you've published. It's called The Man Who Leapt Through Film, The Art of Mamoru Hosoda. Now, here in the West, a lot of people are familiar with the animation director Hayao Miyazaki. Some others will recognize the names Isao Takahata and Satoshi Kon. Mamoru Hosoda hasn't gotten the same cachet, even though his feature film Mirai was nominated for an Oscar back in 2019.
Well, I remember the first film I saw of Hosoda's was Summer Wars, and I was so taken with it. I wrote about it, interviewed him, and wrote about his other films. And when the chance came to do the book about him, I was delighted to do it. Yes, I've interviewed Miyazaki, I interviewed Takahata, I interviewed Satoshi Kon, whose early death was such a loss to the art form. He was in his early 40s and died of pancreatic cancer. But there's a whole group of younger directors in Japan, Hosoda, Makoto Shinkai, Masaki Yuasa, Kenji Kamiyama, who are the next wave. And they're doing things that are exciting and interesting and new. None of them is going to be the new Miyazaki. There isn't going to be a new Miyazaki any more than there was a new Norman McLaren or a new Walt Disney. They've learned from him, but they're pushing things in their own directions. And that's exciting. And I like writing about that. When I started writing about people like Glenn Keane and Andreas Deja and Eric Goldberg and that whole new generation of animators, they were doing new things. And that was exciting to write about. And there's that same excitement in a lot of the work coming out of Japan. And a film like Shinkai's Your Name or Hosoda's Summer Wars and Mirai, these are really interesting films telling us different kinds of stories, giving us different kinds of heroes and heroines and characters, different problems that they're facing, different visual styles. I'm more interested in watching that and writing about it than in seeing the third, fourth, fifth, sixth, 27th version of something. I gave up on comic book movies a couple years ago. I think there's a finite number of explosions you can sit through in one lifetime, and I'm about at my quota. I don't need to see another building blowing up. I'd rather watch the interaction between the characters. Again, in Your Name, it's a really striking, really, I think, a really important film. Look at Summer Wars and contrast how effectively Hosoda plays the cyber world against the real world, I think much more so than the Wreck-It Ralph movies, and that he has a sense of the way the cyber world is important to younger people these days than any Western film I've seen. When you look at Summer Wars and Belle, the cyber world and the real world interlock in ways that I don't think anyone has showed as effectively. Just as Shinkai's been dealing with the trauma the Japanese are still suffering from what they call the Great East Japan Disaster, and we refer to as Fukushima, and the scarring that produced on the psyche of people there. Haruki Murakami, the Japanese novelist, talked about both the sarin gas attacks by the Ohm cult and the Kobe earthquake. He said, this is a turning point in Japanese culture. There will be a before and an after. And I think Fukushima, the Great East Japan Disaster, falls into the same heading, that there is a time before and a time after. And not only the physical destruction, but what it showed about the preparedness of the government and the emergency services, how people responded to it, all have been very, very important and have changed perceptions there. And these artists are grappling with those things. And again, that's exciting to watch, and that's interesting. I'd rather watch that than another butt-kicking princess.
Yeah, speaking of Mamoru Hosoda, he had a very short and not terribly happy time at Studio Ghibli, but in his films, there's still a lot of the same intensity of emotion, of beauty in the environment, of connection between people that you see in the Studio Ghibli films. I remember going to a small art theater to see Hosoda's film Wolf Children. No expectations, hadn't seen anything of his before. It just floored me, beautiful and heartbreaking all the way through.
Yeah, I mean, he's a terrific filmmaker. And that film is, in many ways, his most personal because it was his sort of homage to his mother, who his father had not been around much when he was young. And she had had to raise him. And it was kind of his thank you salute to her. Unfortunately, she died shortly before it was completed. But it's, again, his most personal film. And I think all of those younger directors have learned from the Ghibli artists. Again, Miyazaki is just so good and so prominent. Of course, everyone studied his work and watched it and been influenced by it. And Takahata really wasn't far behind. And he was a director of such versatility that he could do the heartbreaking Grave of the Fireflies, which I've heard described as the most beautiful animated film you never want to see again, to the slapstick of My Neighbors the Yamadas, to the poetry of Princess Kaguya. And, in Japan, you can do that. It is a very different culture with very different assumptions. And it's one of the reasons I've been studying Japanese, is to try and understand some of those concepts better, that there are words for things in Japanese that we don't have in English or other Western languages, and vice versa. There's the whole concept, for example, in art of ma, which is the empty space around something, which you bear in mind when you are creating something, whether it's a brush stroke that has to sum up everything in one sure movement, or a bonsai, or a garden, or something in an animated film. You have to be aware of that. Again, there's no, I don't know of an English word that really corresponds to that.
Well, you've been listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Konser, and my guest today has been Charles Solomon, author of the books The Art of the Disney Golden Books, The Art and Making of Peanuts Animation, Celebrating 50 Years of Television Specials, and Animation for the People, an Illustrated History of the National Film Board of Canada. Charles, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's been fun.
And for those listeners who might be interested in finding out more about your work, more about your books, where would they look?
I have a page on Amazon, like everybody else. That's probably the best place. I'll have a History of Cartoon Saloon coming out this summer. Other people who are doing really interesting work that's different from what we do in this country. I don't have a website, or I'm not on social media. Ursula Le Guin, who was a dear friend from Portland, and I had a standing joke that we belong to an anti-social network where everybody left everybody else in peace. So I've never had a website or anything like that, but I do have a page on Amazon.
That's a great note to go out on. Thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and on the web. You can find an archived version of this show later today at kboo.fm/wordsandpictures. And be sure to follow us on social media at Words and Picture.